So what all are we going to talk about? I know we're talking about Outlaw Star because we said we would. We're supposed to be. Are we going to talk about the My Hero movie?
I have some things to say about the My Hero movie. Okay, yeah.
What order should we do it in? Should we should I think we should probably go through Outlaw Star first, since you know we're supposed to be talking about that one. So for the people who tuned in, since it's right there in the title, we should probably talk about that. So,
we watched episodes 4 through 6.
Right. So how are you liking it? Because I've already seen the show before, so I want to get your reaction first.
I am loving it.
How did you feel about these episodes in particular?
These episodes I actually liked a lot. In fact, I got a lot of Leron vibes.
Oh, well,
from episode 6 at least.
I would say I would push back that there's a bit of nuance on there, in that Leron is he's got a character that he likes to play, that he likes to play up. Fred is just Fred.
Right.
That is just Fred being himself.
So. Yes.
Also,
but the lean in close to the ear and then.
I also love the part, which, by the way, when this first aired on Toonami, all of that was censored. All of the references to him being even slightly homosexual were trimmed right out. But like the part that I forgot and that kills me every time, that he's like, the reason you're allowed to be so rude to the young master is because he loves you. And then they slam the door on him.
And he's like, what is that all about?
And then it's like, we got you a 30% discount. What? I thought you guys told me he loved me.
I'm having a lot of fun. I've laughed a lot more at this show than I've laughed at a number of animes. I can't think of the last anime that I've laughed this much in.
Right. So, I mean, I think we've, at least I've talked about that before. I don't think anime is very funny. Mm-hmm. And I think it's mainly just a cultural difference. Like, there's plenty of times where I understand that something's supposed to be funny. I don't laugh at it. But yeah, no, pretty consistently, Outlaw Star is one of the funnier ones. So, I mean, kind of the major episode out of these three is episode 4. And then 5 and 6 are sort of groundwork, I guess.
Yeah, I will say. Yeah, episode 4 was the finale of kind of the intro.
Yeah, I will say, finale of the intro. I'm not exactly sure if I can say that Act 2 has started yet. It should feel like Hilda dying is like, that's the beginning.
The beginning.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, so this book that I've been reading, it says that Act 2 doesn't begin, you know, after some major life-changing event. Act 2 begins when only this story starts. And that's like a specific distinction. So like the example in the book I was reading called The Story Solution, the writer, Eric Edson, gives the example of E.T. And a lot of people like to say that Act 2 begins when the boy like encounters E.T. for the first time. And it's like, whoa, an alien. Yeah. Like, that's pretty life-changing. But a million different directions the story could go still at that point. But the beginning of Act 2 is when E.T. successfully communicates that he's trying to get home. So now the movie is, we have to get E.T. home.
Right.
Okay. I don't think Act 2 has started for Outlaw Star yet.
Oh, yeah, no, because he's still searching for even just the smallest of answers. He's got the life-changing experience of Hilda dying, as well as the life-changing experience of getting his own ship.
Yes, and, like, getting Excalibur. Out there.
Yes, but there's still no real, like, purpose. I mean, even when Fred asked him what he was doing, he said, I don't know. I think I'm just going to go. No, it was, what's his name? The dude from Blue Heaven.
Swanzo.
It was when Swanzo asked him what he was going to do. He's like, I don't know. I'm just going to go to this place and then we'll go from there.
Yeah. And like the act two feeling is when you know what's happening. The act two feeling right. is if Swanzo asked that and you get this feeling in your gut where, you know, Gene doesn't even have to say anything. Like, you know, what's going to happen now.
Right.
So we're not there yet. They do continue to kind of allude to it, but I'm going to tell you right now, I'm surprised how long it's taking. I can't exactly remember how many episodes were in Outlaw Star, but I am telling you, my memories of Outlaw Star were like the all out sprint for the end.
Yeah.
That
I mean, like, I can tell you just from first time experience, it definitely doesn't feel like it's taking or that it's slowing down or anything like that. Like, I'm still having a ton of fun with it.
Yeah. I did.
So I can totally see how it would go quickly in memory.
Uh-huh. So I guess there's like a weird thing about the pacing here. The pacing is being okay. So it's not slow. Mm-hmm. It's just there is a lot. There is a lot of plot. So the lots of plot they're getting through very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
Even though Act One's lasting a bit longer than I remember it lasting.
Yeah, and it definitely doesn't feel like it's wasting my time.
Yeah. But, like, at this point, you would have been 6 weeks into watching the show. This is why, okay, I think we got a bit of a hypothesis now. I think these shows that we get the feeling start off as episodic, I think that's just mm-hmm. because that's Act One. And Act One is supposed to establish the way things are before the real story begins.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, Trigun feels very episodic in the beginning. And, I mean, that's what people say about it. It's like, oh, Trigun starts episodic and then it becomes, like, this continuous single story that's just point right. A to point B. But, no, I think that's just the groundwork of, like, the hero's journey thing being, like, establish what the regular world is, you know, as mm-hmm. it just is day to day. And then you have the hero cross the first threshold, which I'm not 100% convinced Gene has yet. I may be remembering things kind of wrong. Mm-hmm. But from my memories of the show, it was like A to B, not episodic whatsoever. And if you look at the episode that's kind of like, I mean, they're named after them, more or less. Like, episode 5 is basically Aisha's episode, and then episode 6 is somewhat Suzuka's episode.
Mm-hmm.
And they feel somewhat episodic. I loved
episode 6.
Yeah.
I loved episode 6.
I loved that fight.
Mm-hmm.
And I love how it ends, too. Or like, sort of gets postponed.
I love his resolution to Fred's problem.
Uh-huh. And I like his way of, like, talking his way around her, like, hard honor system. Like, she mm-hmm. can't diverge from this one style. And he, like, is able to kind of not really trick her, but he, like, finds the caveats to at least delay right. it for now. Yeah, no, Gene is an extremely likable protagonist because he does that stuff routinely. Also, in episode 5, I was going to say, the beginnings of the romantic subplot with him and Melfina is really mm-hmm. well done. Like, the way he talks to her, like, I like the part where they're talking about or where he says, I guess I'll bleep this in the podcast, but when he says, I'd rather eat... and she's like, yeah, me too.
Yeah, me
and he's
too.
Like, you'd rather eat... and she's like, I mean, no, maybe. It's like, there's really good chemistry, and it doesn't feel yes. forced.
No, not in the slightest. And like, when he was sitting there inspecting, like, her face and, like, pinching it and pulling it and, like, describing to her the fact that she's feeling all these things.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was pretty cool.
Also, good Blade Runner vibes.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd like to reiterate that the I mean, you know, you could get all kinds of stuff from Blade Runner. It's a pretty deep and thick. It's a very thick movie, I should say. Mm-hmm. But it's hearty. There's a lot that you can walk away from Blade Runner, walk away with. It's early in the morning, boys. A lot you can walk away with from Blade Runner. The main one that I think.
Well done.
Thank you. It took me a couple tries, but I think I'm proud of the final product. I think the main one, which has to do with like, is Deckard a replicant or not?
Mm-hmm.
It isn't the material reality as to whether or not Deckard is a replicant. And, you know, here's mm-hmm. my thing. I absolutely despise any and all open-ended endings, but Blade Runner doesn't have one. The ending of Blade Runner is not open-ended at all. I'm, of course, talking about the final cut.
Right. Are you talking?
You're not talking
about the one where Harrison Ford came back and recorded a bunch of monologuing.
Goodness, no. Not that one. Although it is way better than 2049, but that we won't get into that. The message of the original Blade Runner was that at this point, Deckard realized that in the city, doing his job as the Blade Runner, he might as well be a replicant. He was just a machine, like just a cog in a machine, doing what he's told, just going through the motions and missing like life itself, like missing all of the things that I can never remember his name, but the replicant that, you know, dies in the rain, that iconic scene. That guy was living a richer life than Deckard was. And, you know, at the end, Deckard leaves that life. And that being the message of Blade Runner. And then 2049, you know, like all Hollywood remakes, decides to destroy everything. Not remake, but, you know, re-up.
Requel.
The extra. Goodness, I should not. Anyway.
The Eye of Sauron draws closer.
There's so much of this that I like, I go back and forth on editing, and then I'm like, in the end, I probably should just take it out. It's probably for the best. Anyway, so yeah, episode 4 is really the big one as far as plot. Episode 5 and 6 do, you know, they have character development, which is obviously super important, and they've got, you know, they're a lot of fun, but like the big moment as far as like Gene kind of taking his place as the actual protagonist is in episode 4 when Hilda doesn't make it out. And
when she literally bites it.
That's a good one. I liked how her death was not super cheesily written. Like, she really wanted to get out of there. Like, she was constantly saying, come get me, Gene, or whatever.
Yeah, and like, bailing from her ship into the escape pod, then bailing from the escape pod into her own little, like, her
spacesuit.
Suit, yeah.
And, like, also, great aim on connecting that thing to that tiny little wire in the middle of kidding. Space.
Since it was, like, it wasn't even, like, looped around it. It was, like...
Yeah.
Pinched between.
Right. It wasn't her fault at all that she didn't make it out of there. She was doing her best.
Right.
It was also like, I don't know. It was effectively sad because it wasn't melodramatic. Like, it wasn't like from the start. Mm-hmm. So that scene takes a while, but it isn't like the whole time she's like, you know, doing the sacrifice yourself to save everyone else thing. And it's going to be really drawn out. Like,
it's building up to the hopelessness of it.
Right. I find those to be way more effective. And this show constantly seems to do the more effective ways of doing anything. From what I can tell, I'm going to tell you right now, what I remember from Outlaw Star was how much I liked like the style and the character designs and the locations. I don't remember it being this good at like a screenwriting level.
Yeah, it's got great execution.
Yeah, I don't remember the execution being this good. At least at the time, it wasn't what I knew it for, But now it's like, oh, that's a very pleasant surprise. You can kind of feel, let's see, when did Outlaw Star come out? 1998. Oh my God. Oh, yeah. 98 was so good. So this was a good bit after Saint Seiya, but all the kind of, dated issues that you get from Saint Seiya were by now totally ironed out. Like any of the issues anime could have had with pacing, you know, the stuff that say Dragon Ball and Naruto are known for. And you know, you kind of, you're more likely to forgive Saint Seiya just because of the time it came out in, where it's like, well, Saint Seiya is melodrama,
right?
This is like, I mean, I don't want to, you know, just I'm hesitant to think that it's like, well, it's because it's from the 90s and that's why I want to think it's the best. But it really does feel like this area, like we were done having all of the filler, like the junk. We had figured out what was junk and everything that we should include. Like it's now a known factor because it's just being deployed here. So in like, even if there's filler episodes later that I've forgotten about, at least in these first six, you don't make these first six episodes without knowing exactly what you're doing. Like without knowing exactly what is necessary. If you do a filler episode later, it's because, you know, of budget, or like we have to make time. We've got this amount of episodes and this amount of plot.
Right.
Like to spread these out to make it to where there's less filler overall would make them all worse, which is, you know, that's the One Piece method of doing it, which is to not have the filler episode, but to simply stretch all of the actual canon plot out to the point where
you're injecting Botox into the plot.
Yeah. It's like, well, oh my God, now the canon risks being filler, which is like nightmarish. That's like post-apocalyptic. That's a dystopian reality. That's the one that One Piece has wrought. But it wasn't because there wasn't a problem they were trying to solve, but the problem kind of just seems solved when you're like, okay, 26 episodes for the whole story.
Yeah.
And I kind of think that that's where we should stay. And it's kind of, you know, this seems to be all of the issues I have with My Hero Academia, at least where it is right now. You know, at the time, it was the chosen one because it was the, you know, the long running shonen anime that was going to be seasonal. It wasn't going to be constant like the big three are. But now I'm starting to think, oh wait, it's still the long running and shonen
same traps.
Yeah. Right. It's still the thing where it's like, this is going to take 10 years to tell this story. And I don't know about y'all, but I am now 29 and taking 10 years to tell a story does not interest me. It's no longer a thing that sounds like, oh, wow, that's epic. Like I did, you know, back when Destiny was being teased.
Yes, that's exactly what I was about.
And I think it's funny because like the original Destiny, when it was being advertised as this is going to be a 10-year journey, in the end, it was like, good Lord, I'm glad that wasn't, huh? Like, I'm sure glad they cut that short and sold us a sequel. And I'm glad that I didn't buy it because after the first one, I knew better. But like the whole 10-year plan thing is something that sounds good on paper, I think, to teenagers. Where it's like, whoa, 10 years? That's like almost my whole life. Also, I'm going to live forever, which is what every teenager thinks.
Right.
That is thought two after every thought they have. A teenager will think one thing and then immediately afterward think, I'm going to live forever.
Should I jump off of this balcony? Of course, I'm going to live forever.
Exactly. So like the prospect of I'm going to be watching Naruto from age 11 to age 21 may sound kind of cool to someone who's 11, you know, kind of just like Toy Story doing that thing where it kind of aged, like the age of Andy was the age of the viewer with how long it took to come out. That was pretty cool in the moment.
Yes, but, it was very special when the third movie came out. When the fourth movie came out, I was like, why are we here?
Yeah, when the fourth movie came out, it's like, oh no, this is a stupid idea. Making a movie about toys is dumb. We made a big mistake doing the first three. Also, the iconic trait of Woody being the one who learned to be loyal and never leave your side. He's going to leave you. All of you. Spoiler again. Warning. Woody leaves. And that's the message.
Wait, does he leave at the end? I haven't seen the fourth one.
Oh, yeah, it's awful. Right, yes. No, the central message is Woody ditches everyone. Which, I mean,
what a dirtbag.
Like, yeah, you can see it coming. Given that every Hollywood film is about good guy, bad. But yeah. Well, or the other message is people trying to survive are going to do what they can to survive. We'll change that into, no, these are the good guys and these are the bad guys, which is exactly what the new Dune is. But we won't talk about that. for episode 4, Hilda getting killed off was an extremely good scene. And then I like how Gene reacts to it. Gene doesn't just get PTSD because he already has PTSD from his dad dying.
From his dad, yeah.
We don't give him new PTSD, but I do like the scene where he's like, maybe it is bothering me or something like that. And it like replays in his head, like her exploding.
Yeah, he was frustrated because it was like he couldn't figure out his feelings toward it and Melfina could. And then he goes and he's like, maybe I am angry.
Yeah, which once again, great build up for like their chemistry is like a romantic subplot. But again, it's just a subplot. Like Outlaw Star isn't a love story.
Mm-hmm.
But you wouldn't know that because six episodes in and it still really hasn't gotten going. But we at least have the device. We now have, you know, Mjolnir. Mm-hmm. We have Excalibur there. We've got the core drill. It's finally shown itself.
Right.
And it's, I'm gonna say, as much as I like the little opening things with the voice actor for Jet Black, you know, describing things from the show, as much as I like those, in the show itself, I thought they did way better in explaining what the grapplers were, because it was this kind of cool moment where you see Gene's reaction to what Hilda's talking about. Like describing the ship as a grappler and like describing that this is a grappler and like, you know, we're going to take this and like they owe me or whatever. That stuff's cool. And the fact that she's like setting them up as the crew and Gene is like, I don't know what I'm doing. And like his face, his like, not just the dialogue, but like his facial reactions to like being handed the controls of something that he at least has heard about means that that's enough for you to have heard about it. I don't know. I just thought that like that scene was so well done that the part at the beginning kind of undermines it a little bit where they're like, you know, explaining the grapplers, like a mesh of like technology and like human ingenuity or whatever. Like,
yeah,
you kind of,
I appreciate the backdrop that it gives, but yeah, I do see your point.
I really liked it in the moment. And then, you know, later when he takes it back to Swanzo and, or I mean, even in the actual like conflict when, McDougal and the pirates attack them, it's like, it doesn't have any weapons. It only has the grapple arms. I don't know. I just thought that was a much better way to do it rather than, Like, imagine if you had a voiceover that introduced. That maybe not the best example. I was going to talk about Mad Max, but there's not really like a specific unique technology to Mad Max. It really was just like the mastery of the internal combustion engine is like the thing in Mad Max.
Yeah,
I don't know. And then I was going to maybe say Star Wars, but Star Wars definitely has that whole iconic opening title crawl. Darn it.
Yeah, but maybe like a good kind of parallel would be if somebody was introducing Immortan Joe in voiceover, like right before we experienced
that's
him.
More of a general thing where it's like, you know, show don't tell. But I was more describing like you can. The part where people get kind of tripped up on this is that the lore is very important, especially to sci-fi people, because with fantasy, you can kind of pull from the dense, rich, universal mythology that humans have been going through their entire lives and continue to live to this day, whether they want to realize that or not. But with sci-fi, that's like the loophole. That's where it's like, okay, but we literally aren't here. Like, this is supposed to be where we could end up, but we aren't.
Right.
But I would push back and say that at least, maybe to just avoid that whole conversation, Outlaw Star ducks that by having the pirates be like Towmasters. And the explanation for how do they track us? Probably a Tau spell. And it's like, you don't have to explain that at all. Like, specifically, these group of pirates that's been chasing them, they've not labored who or what they are. Like, you're just watching it. You're watching the story.
And now they're dead.
Right. You're getting Gene's experience from this. And you know about as much as he does, but that's as much as you need to know. And I know that, like, especially fans of sci-fi who would be particularly pissed off with the new Dune movie. I get that you're allergic to people being lazy when lore is really important, but it would be different if the person that is making the story, it's different when they know the lore. If they know their universe and they're telling the story, there's not going to be a problem. There's not going to be laziness. It's not going to be, oh, let's change the rules later on, or let's leave things out when we forget or something like that. The writer, they're the person that has to go through the boring, you know, they have to tell it to themselves and then they show you.
Right.
So
yeah,
it's really a situation where the writer is the only person who needs to understand all of the lore.
Yeah, because they're the ones who have to mingle it in later on.
Right. And if they know it and it's been like fleshed out, like if the lore is full, they're not going to, you know, have to write it as they go later on. Then there's not going to be any laziness in the writing. The laziness would come from someone who's just making it up as they go, which I mean, there's plenty of that in sci-fi. And I think that's why people are like knee jerk. They're like, I don't want to accept that. I'm fine with the telling, because if they tell me, then I know that they're doing their work. But when you can just edit those parts out after the fact, I guess right. That's the point I'm trying to make, is that if the parts where they tell you can just be edited out and it all still works, then
they shouldn't have told you.
Right. It's unnecessary. That being said, stylistically and atmospherically, those opening things are really cool, and I do like them. They're probably the best case scenario.
Yes.
They're kind of like the intro things for Clone Wars, with like that voiceover where it's like you're watching a 1940s propaganda film.
I love it.
Brilliant. Just good job. Best it could be done. And the good thing about the Clone Wars ones is that they are showing you more than just telling you, like the Star Wars films do, which just have the, you know, the opening crawl. They actually like show you scenes of the things happening.
Right.
But yeah. So anyway, talking about specifically the content of the episodes themselves, there's a little bit of a certain belt trait that is starting to show itself in Outlaw Star.
I was going to mention that because you had said in one of the previous recordings, I guess the last one, since we're only on episode 6, that this was not a candidate for belt. But then when I was seeing the way that he was treating the antagonists uh-huh. of some of these episodes, I was like, wait a minute.
Yeah. So when I suggested this show, it wasn't based on the idea that it could be considered belt, but I mean, episode 5 and 6 are more or less future ally stories,
right?
Where it's like these are bad guys now that want us dead, but later they'll probably
and then at the end of the episodes they're like slightly aggravated at the main character,
right?
Rather than I want to kill him.
Yeah and also actually, I'm going to wait on that one because we're going to get a clearer vision of that once we're further in the show. And it could be as soon as next week. So I'll put that one on the back burner. That being said, this isn't like out and out, like super on its face. Okay, at least the way that I'm remembering it, because, again, the thing I remember best from this was how cool I thought everything looked. But specifically, the way the story goes, it's not that it's anti-belt. It's not Neon Genesis Evangelion. But it's... it's kind of a... like, okay, Die Hard isn't belt. Mad Max isn't belt.
Right. Yeah.
And at least as I remember it, this is more of a Die Hard or a Mad Max than it is a Gurren Lagann. But at least, I guess as far as the hero, he's Gene isn't much of an anti-hero. Like, despite the way things start, like his disposition just isn't much of a fit.
Right.
Like, he's not cold-blooded or ruthless. Like, he actually will go out of his way to avoid killing people.
Yeah. And, like, I mean, he had multiple chances to kill Suzuka, and he just kept shooting at the ground around her. And then, like, said, all right, well, then you're dead.
Yes.
All right, so stop.
Right. But also, he did point blank fire a caster shell at Aisha. But it was in the circumstances where it's like, okay, yeah, she has said she's going to kill you. Right. And it's like, well, I've tried diplomacy. Let's see how immortal you are. And then it, you know, turns out she's able to shrug it off. But it doesn't.
She's very immortal.
Yeah, but it doesn't incapacitate her.
Right.
But, you know, you're okay. So I guess he's not a Kamina or a Simon. He is much closer to a later Han Solo, though.
Yeah. Okay.
So, like, he is. Maybe earlier he would have shot first. Now he's at least going to make sure before he shoots.
Yeah.
But he will shoot if he needs to.
Right. Yeah, I'm digging this show. I'm digging the feel. It feels I don't know. It feels like a brighter what's it freaking
Cowboy
called?
Bebop.
Cowboy Bebop. Yeah.
I would say it kind of falls somewhere between Trigun and Cowboy Bebop. It's the missing link. And it's like, I kind of, it's funny because apparently Outlaw Star, at least when I was learning about it, Outlaw Star was considered like second most popular and Trigun was third. But then, I mean, maybe there's like revisionist history or whatever. It was just like my experience when I was first, you know, looking out into the abyss to find these things. After I saw Firefly and I wanted more like it, the thing people always recommended was Cowboy Bebop.
Mm-hmm.
And then sometimes when people are like, oh, a space Western, Trigun.
Yeah.
Whereas Outlaw Star is probably the most like Firefly, because Gene feels way more. Okay, he's not as like, he's not old and cynical, or I should say older and cynical. And he's also, you know, fresh. He's very new. He's not weathered like Malcolm Reynolds is. But he, as far as disposition, he's way more like him. Like,
yeah, also, I mean, I can't help but draw the parallel between Melvina and Summer.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Or River, yeah, I River. Guess.
Which, I mean, that's as far as just the characters having, like, analogs. Yeah, I mean, that's, like, the most obvious analog. And it seems like Outlaw Star, more than Cowboy Bebop, influenced Firefly.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't know, like just... I don't know how I can reconcile a potential reality where Joss Whedon didn't see this show before writing Firefly. Not that Joss Whedon has a lot of like anime references or like kind of Japanese influence in his stuff, because I'd say he doesn't. I'd say it's surprising how little there is there when you compare it to, you know, all of his other contemporaries. I'd say Zack Snyder has seen way more anime. Just as a comparison, you know, the praise for Man of Steel at the time was that it was as if you got live action Dragon Ball, not as if you got live action Superman.
Right.
So, I mean, you can definitely feel it more in his peers, I would say. But there's just too much. There's too much Outlaw Star and Firefly for me to think that there's not like a very obvious, like at least he skimmed it, like how M. Night Shyamalan skimmed Avatar The Last Airbender before making The Last Airbender.
there was a moment in these past three episodes that I thought of another movie or TV show or something where I was like, it feels like they got that beat from this. And I can't remember what part. I should have written it down.
Speaking of getting beats from things, I learned recently that not only is Demon Slayer extremely derivative and boring, but they straight up ripped. Like now I'm very hesitant to say ripped off. It doesn't mean anything anymore. Like people would say that, I don't know. Back in the day that like if there was some feature that Call of Duty added to the game, that Battlefield ripped them off by adding that feature to their game. And I'm like, no, it's just quality of life. It's just people being smart and taking ideas from each other because the ideas make everything better.
Right.
But like, that's a stupid, perfect example to explain to you how fed up I am with this whole phenomenon. You got me talking about Call of Duty and Battlefield. But
gross. Let's move on.
But like saying that something's ripped off, I'm like, no, like nothing's really original. Also, you should be ripping off everyone as best you can. But
yeah,
there is a scene in Demon Slayer. I don't know if it was the movie or the show because I'm not watching that crap, but someone put it right next to like the iconic Vega versus Chun-Li fight in the Street Fighter 2 movie, which is like known as like one of the most tense animated action set pieces ever. They put it side by side with the scene in Demon Slayer. It was like shot for shot, like exact time code and everything stolen directly from the Street Fighter 2 movie, which is crazy because you'd think, oh, well, everyone's going to pick up on that, right? But then it's like, no, enough time has passed. There's enough time in between these where Demon Slayer probably thought we could just use that. We can just take that directly from it.
Oh, man. It kind of reminds me of when Disney copied themselves. I'm not looking at the.
Okay, well, at least in that it was stuff that they owned. And it was like,
right. This is extremely there's a big difference.
Yeah, this is extremely expensive. So let's save some money.
And it wasn't in a time that you could like that you had easy access to like revise like movies back to back.
That's more like Voltron reusing a transformation sequence. Like I think it's closer to that because it's the same people more or less using the same character designs. Like I would argue Little John from Robin Hood and Baloo from the Jungle Book, they're more or less supposed to be the same dude.
Yeah, it's like almost like an animal actor.
Yeah, like, and which is convenient when you're reusing animations, but
right,
it was almost like, hey, let's make Robin Hood anthropomorphic because then we can reuse Jungle Book animation.
I love Robin Hood.
I think that one's aged pretty well compared to a lot of the other. I mean, I think Jungle Book has aged great because you know what that movie is? Short. I like that one a lot. You can watch the Jungle Book in like an hour. I think it's, it might just be an hour long. Brilliant. Bravo. Do it again. Reuse those animations. Really stretch that hour. Anyway, no, but I would say it's not quite the same thing because this is a thing like, they didn't reuse the animation. That's what I'm saying. You're not saving money on workload. It was still all original animation. You're saving money on creativity, which, I mean, basically sums up Demon Slayer to a T. There's not a single original idea in the whole thing. However, there is a very original character design that is great. That is the little sister. Like, that is a really cool original idea. I just wish there was more. Not that I'm bothered. I'm not watching it. But what were we talking about? What got us on that?
Story beats.
Which ones? I'm totally lost now.
I was talking about that there was a story beat in the past three episodes that reminded me of something, and you said, "Oh, speaking of story beats."
Oh, sorry. Go ahead. Yeah.
Oh no! I couldn't remember what the story beat was.
Okay. Oops.
I was trying to remember it in the moment, and I couldn't.
Well, hopefully, a tangent will help you. I guess it didn't. My hypothesis was incorrect. I was unsuccessful in giving you a tangent. Also, I realize this was the era where anime episodes were 25 minutes, not 22 minutes. There was an extra 3 minutes that wasn't used by ad space. Remember what they took from you. An extra 3 whole minutes. That being said, I think maybe credit sequences were longer, and then like you still have the intro and you still have the preview for the next episode. So, meh, it probably shakes out at about even. But
that intro is still a banger.
Oh man, I love it. I can't. At least the first time, I can't skip it.
You're same.
And I like the. It's not even that it's like particularly impressive, unlike the animation, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. But like the composition of it, I don't know. It's really well done. I like me some double exposure. That's not the word. Superimposition. You know, in Lion King, where Simba's running back and you got the slow-mo of like he's running through the sand. And then like in the wider shot that you're also seeing is when it's like the distant horizon shot of him running across the sand.
Oh, yeah, it's like superimposed.
OK, yeah, superimposed. OK, it works. There we go. I went to film school, so I forgot everything. Clearly
they told you forget everything you know, and you forgot everything and never learned anything else. Yes, right.
I took them at their word, man. $40,000 in debt. I gotta take it seriously. I don't think maybe we did talk about that, but we definitely did at least in maybe episode two. But, like, this show's action direction is great.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's...
it's very snappy.
It's snappy, and it's, like, fun.
Mm-hmm.
Even up to the point where Hilda has to, like, sacrifice herself at the end. That scene was, like... it's just got energy. Like, it's alive.
Yeah.
It doesn't feel like it's going through the motions. And you would say that, like, man, a scene as obligatory as... Aisha like trying to jump them in the street and like everything falling apart so they can like escape, and it's like, yep, and then later on she's gonna try again. Like,
yeah, like the kick that she threw when she jumped around him when he was running away.
Yeah.
Like that was just a simple little kick, and that's like stuck in my mind because it was just a fun moment.
Right. And it was kind of funny. Like, right. It was kind of slapstick to see Gene not take it seriously, so she just kicks him right in the face. And it was like, in a comedically athletic way, where it's like, this is a character who is just exuding, don't take me seriously. Like, as much as she needs you to take her seriously, she like, so you don't take her seriously. So then she just completes this incredible feat just to kick him in the face. Yeah. Then the scene in the alleyway where she's like doing her big transformation. And then it's like, its strength depends on the face of the moon. And they're like, but we don't have a moon. And she's like, oh. You're right. Like, yeah, she's still the antagonist of the episode. And it's still fun. It's still fun to watch. Like, I'm glued to the screen. For episode 6, I mean, those were actually tense. Like, because here's the thing. You don't really buy it when you're this early in the show and the hero is in danger. You can't really, it's like, okay, well, I mean, he's probably going to be fine. I mean, at worst, he's going to get a cyborg arm out of the worst possible encounter. Like,
right.
That's just how these things go. But in episode 6, when he's trying to keep a different character who, like, just got introduced alive and is, you know, the good thing about stories,
he's cannon fodder. Like, he could easily be swallowed up by the plot.
Right. Yeah, he could. Like there's nothing about this archetype that tells you, oh, he's going to make it out alive. So Gene having to protect that character, that actually makes it really intense. Mm-hmm. Because if she can even like, what's the word? Not disarm. Neutralize. If she could just like neutralize Gene, like interim, make it to where he can't protect Fred. Fred's basically dead. So there's actually like
Fred's dead.
There's actual like tension in that episode. And the part where she cut that truck in half with a wooden sword, for some reason I like remembered. I was like, oh right, this isn't hard sci-fi. Like, there's actual like more or less magic.
Yeah, they keep you plugged into it. Like, they keep reminding you, like, hey, this isn't just, you know,
I mean,
guns and lasers.
Right. They kind of do a little a sleight of hand with Aisha and like the Katarl, because it's an alien, so you can basically give those whatever rules you want. But when it comes to humans, you know, you're expected to treat them like most people treat humans in hard sci-fi. But this like goes beyond. I was trying to think. I was like, why does this strike me as so fresh, so strange in comparison to something like Star Wars, which is extremely spiritual and like basically centers around this ancient religion? I think it's because Gene isn't one of the people using, like he isn't a magic user, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that might be it, because he only has like a passing relationship to the magic with the caster guy.
Yeah. It's a completely materialistic, I guess, relationship with any of the magic in the universe.
And so it makes everything else just that much more mystical. And I mean, like the Tau Masters, the pirates, they're kind of like crazy and like the way that they go about things. And so it's very daunting to look at the magic in the world. They're like, they're very imposing and very intimidating. Also, that girl was really creepy. That's what I'm getting to, right? Is the girl creeping out.
Okay, I see. That makes it different from Star Wars for sure. But like this specific, like this character, like, okay, so it is like if Han Solo was the main character of Star Wars, and Han Solo never really, you know, he never uses the Force per se. He eventually says, may the Force be with you. But that's because he isn't the protagonist, and the story was about that. The story was about Luke growing stronger in the Force.
Right. There is a moment in Star Wars where I get this feeling, and that's when the witches are introduced.
I beg your pardon?
The in the Clone Wars, the show where the witches who like resurrect, or they don't resurrect and like they become zombies later on, which is really creepy. But they're the ones who like turn Savage into
they turn the males of that species like basically into superhumans through the use of, I mean, the dark side, but it's a new kind of dark side that we haven't seen.
Yeah, it's like a really gross.
Well, and it's kind of like, this is a big one. This is going to be really hard to communicate without sounding like a kook, but I mean,
okay.
And it also might, you know,
is it the time elves?
Oh, sort of. Yeah, no, that's a great example. Like the clockwork elves in whatever are like, oh, they're like these weird creatures. And then, you know, grays, like the way people see grays, that sort of alien archetype. And it's like, no, those are demons. Mm-hmm. They're just, you're just seeing them different than the way you're used to seeing them. You know, it's not a dude with goat horns. You just not a dude with red skin and goat horns. It's like, no, that's still a demon. It's still from hell, but that I understand that is kind of esoteric to suddenly start going off about clockwork elves, especially when no one, maybe someone doesn't know what you're talking about. But specifically, just to give people an idea, I want to say, is it DMT or like ayahuasca or something? Some kind of big hallucinogenic drug.
Ayahuasca is the big one.
Is it? Because I know DMT is the one that like Joe Rogan talks about. I don't know.
I'm fairly certain ayahuasca is like the more natural version of it.
Okay. I have no knowledge of any of this, so I'm just flying by the seat of my pants here.
Well, I'm also doing the same thing. So that's probably why I probably shouldn't even attempt to explain this. Mm-hmm. But they're like two hallucinogenic drugs where people claim to like see like robotic elf people. And they're like, oh, that's really strange. I wonder what they're trying to say. I'm like, yeah, they're demons. Those are demonic beings. But that's, in order to explain that is even more esoteric. And I mean, this is an anime podcast. This isn't Bible study. So we do have to check ourselves. Trigun was our one. We were given Trigun. We were handed Trigun on a silver platter. It's like, hey, look, talk about Christianity. But the comparison... Yes, that was a good comparison where it's like you're seeing a different version of what is essentially the same thing. Mm-hmm. Or it's like, yeah, it turns out the evil sorcerers from all over the galaxy are all using the dark side. It's all the same evil force.
Yeah, but it remystifies it and kind of makes it a little scarier.
Yes, which is it's good. You should be you should fear it. It should be mystic. But yeah, and certainly at that point, like when you're watching Clone Wars, you've seen some Star Wars where I would say when Palpatine started shooting lightning at his fingertips, that was like, oh, whoa. Like the first time you see that, it's like, hey, yeah, I have not seen this.
As far as I know, you could just move rocks.
That was a good joke. That's an underrated joke. Yeah, so the Townmasters in this, if Star Wars had been about Han Solo, it would stay mystic. The Force would stay mystic, and there would not be a point where Han Solo says, "May the Force be with you," because he would have been the protagonist, and it would have been about a completely different story.
Right,
if that makes sense. But
yeah,
this is what that looks
makes
like.
Sense to me.
Right. So
dear viewer, so
to let you know. This is not the story of Jean essentially becoming a sword mage. Like this is Jean becoming something totally different. Like his Excalibur is not the Tau magic or, I mean, it's not just Tau magic in this. Like I'm pretty sure Suzuka is not using Tau magic. She's not. She's come from somewhere completely different. And she's also not just performing a physical feat, which it sucks that I have to belabor this. And the reason it sucks is because I know there's people just like me circa 2017 who aren't going to get it. But physical feats, none of them are completely unmystical. But like, she's not, you know, doing the Tau spells that the pirates are using in order to swing her wooden sword and make gusts of wind craters that blow holes in buildings. Yeah. Like that is a physical feat. Yes. But it's not just a physical feat. But yeah, that shows up in episode 6, and it was like enough time had passed to where I had forgotten. And it was like, yeah, whoa, what the heck? Like it was
just enough to remind you in a very like in your face way.
Yeah, it was shocking. It was like, how is she doing that? And then it's like, oh, right. There's some strange things happen in this universe, which is not strange at all. It's not strange that there are strange things.
Yeah, and it's great that it's putting you in the same kind of position as the main character, because the main character would probably have a similar reaction, like, wow, you just did that.
But he was the one that was able to deduce how she snuck it in there. He's like, she's using a wooden sword, which, again, I like that Gene is competent. He's not just fresh faced. Mm-hmm. In fact, he literally isn't. He's got a big facial scar, but
right.
He's literally the opposite of fresh faced, but we are getting, despite that, okay, this is something I think is frequently misunderstood amongst, like, amateur screenwriters, is they think the story has to begin at the beginning, so we have to get the flashback, when it's like, no, you can have a character who's more or less established in his own world, and then start dragging him kicking and screaming into a new one. Which is what is happening here. So it's actually really convenient. In fact, new writers should try to do that more often, because then you don't have to explain, why does Gene have the knowledge that these bodyguards don't? And it's all, well, Gene is pretty familiar with the criminal underground and that kind of stuff. Like he's a mercenary in the start. Yeah. He's kind of becoming what is known as an outlaw, you know, capital O outlaw in this universe, which is sort of its own thing.
Right.
I don't know if this authentically segues into what we were just talking about, but I guess I just want to say I really do appreciate how well this show is written. And I feel like this is a thing that I see happen a lot, where people will talk about how good anime used to be. And it's like, you are picking up on that these were good. Like when people think of, you know, I mean, the ones we've been talking about, Trigun, Cowboy Bebop, Outlaw Star, when they think about these being so good, they kind of don't know what to say after that. Like I kind of roll my eyes every time I see yet another Cowboy Bebop video essay come through and get recommended to me on YouTube, which I will not watch. Like, I'm kind of just over it. I'm like, I don't want to hear someone break this down again, because it's like, I know they're going to miss the point, because I know that I'm going to miss the point in trying to tell people why they're good. But I think I'm starting to get the point. When it's like, the thing that I liked about Outlaw Star was not it's well written, because you don't notice good writing.
Right. You notice bad writing.
Right. Like when I'm going to have to talk about it, that's when I start to notice it. But if I was just watching anime, like I think this is, you know, this is probably why Zoids wasn't good to watch for the show, because it's like, I have to qualify this. It's like I had to critique this silly little time-wasting kids show. But with Outlaw Star, it's like it's those moments where it's like, oh, I can't wait to talk about this because it's great. Like it's great from a critical perspective.
Yeah. As well as just from a passerby.
Yeah. But like, that's the thing. The only reason a critic would say anything is for a passerby to hear it. And it's like the best thing I can say to get someone to watch Outlaw Star is it's just really good. You should watch it. You know what? You know what's better than that? You know what's better than saying Outlaw Star is good? Saying Outlaw Star is cool. Because that gives someone a totally different feeling. When they're expecting something good, they're like, wanting to see something like Cowboy Bebop. When you tell him something's cool, I don't know why I'm taking a jab at Cowboy Bebop all of a sudden, but when you tell someone something's cool, their expectations are different, where it's like, oh, I'm just going to go enjoy this. Mm-hmm. I don't have to go appreciate it. And maybe I'm borrowing from Uber Boyo a little bit, but I think you should stop appreciating things. I think you should instead enjoy them.
Mm. That's good. That's good. I like that.
I don't know if that's where I want to stop talking about it. There's so much that we could. Oh, wow. We already went an hour, didn't we?
Yeah.
Oops. Dang. I still had more to talk about for Outlaw Star. Dang. Maybe I should try to go quick. Are there any more thoughts you want to get out real quick? I like how I tell you, get your thoughts out real quick, because I just spent an hour. I just took all of the time. So if you want a word in, you're gonna have to shout over me and be.
No, it's good show. Flashy, good show.
It's cool, yeah. Okay, so here's the problem. I keep thinking I'm gonna spoil something, so I probably shouldn't. But I really like these characters. I really like this ensemble. Mm-hmm. It gets better. The ensemble gets even better, and it gets much better when Act Two really gets underway. When it's like you can now see the arc. You know, there's that point in Kill la Kill where it kind of shows all of the people standing in her way, like between her and Satsuki. It's mm-hmm. like you kind of see where the story's going. Of course, you know, there's a few twists and turns here and there, but right. we aren't at that point. That scene hasn't happened yet. But after that scene happens, it gets much cooler. They have a title, or not title dropped. They have dropped the name of the thing that is going to be like the catalyst for Act Two a couple times right or by now. But yeah, this is kind of the point where. Well, that kind of gets into other stuff. So, we'll get there. Probably the next time we cover it. So I won't belabor it. So what do we want to talk about? Do we want to talk about My Hero now? After we're an hour in? Okay.
What did you think of the movie?
I really liked it, but I liked it for a completely different reason than I liked the first two. Because it's a completely different movie.
Okay. How many times did you see it?
I only saw it once.
Okay, so I saw it once, and I came out, or sorry, I saw it twice. The first time I came out disappointed.
Really? Okay, I want to hear why.
So
I mean, unless I guess you're getting to a different point about after you saw it the second time. Go ahead. I'll let you talk.
Well, yeah, so the first time that I saw it, I was really disappointed because I was expecting, it was definitely my expectations. I realized after watching it the second
time. Oh, dude, the first trailer totally lied. The first trailer,
I can't
absolutely. The first trailer is only from the very beginning of the movie, where it's them in the stealth suits jumping out of that plane.
Oh yeah.
And it's like the global mission thing that they're all going to go on. That is not mm-hmm. what the movie is about in the slightest.
Right, but it wasn't even that expectation.
Is a misleading title, I would argue.
No, but so it wasn't even that expectation. Okay. It was literally the expectation of quality as well as like focus.
Oh, okay.
So like between the first two movies, like I was remembering the high highs of the second movie.
Oh yeah.
And then when I came out of the third movie and I was like, that did not set my soul ablaze.
I gotcha.
And so I was and the first one that I watched was the sub.
Okay.
And so then the next night I went to the dub. And I had a much better time with it. One, the theater that I was in was actually a little better of an experience, or the crowd at least. Save for a couple of Deku my babies. And it's like, all right.
Oh god.
Man, calm it down.
I'm gonna tell you right now, this show is doing some damage to some women. And I'm starting to think maybe they should be banned from watching it because I had the same stuff has happened in the theater all three times I've seen a My Hero movie in the theater. It's like, there's some chick being possessive of a fictional character. And I'm like, this is why I didn't want to go see Twilight. But I thought that I would be free of that. Watching the dang... A dang Punch Man cartoon.
Dang old anime.
Yeah, an anime where they do the punch hard. Oh well.
But so the second night that I went, one, there's a number of lines that they approach very differently in the dub.
Interesting. So I only saw the dub.
Okay. Well, I really loved the changes that they made between the sub and the dub. And they're very subtle changes, but they kind of changed the way that the line was delivered. Some of them weren't as good. Like the scene when Endeavor, when he's bursting through the front door of that facility, there's a line that he says where he's like, this is what resistance gets you. He says that in the dub. But in the sub, it was a little bit cooler, but all the other changes.
I
want to
hear what it was in the sub.
I can't remember exactly what he said.
Because I wanted to go oink oink at that.
Oh gosh, I can't remember. I can't remember the exact wording. It was very similar, but the delivery was just like, it was something more along the lines of, if you resist, I will not show any mercy, or something like that.
Well, also, I would say, as much as I vastly prefer the dub cast, Endeavor's Japanese voice actor is an absolute god. Like, every time it's like, oh, we're doing a sub episode, but I see Endeavor's in it, it's like, oh, cool, I get to hear that guy.
Yeah, there. But there are there were a number of changes between just like the dialogue between Deku and Rhodey, and it just made it flow a little bit better for me. I guess it was just like the cultural difference between the sub and the dub.
Perhaps
it's like they adapted more to the American culture,
which
for the dub.
I would argue this isn't going to be popular, but I think that is their job.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I would agree with that. And it made the dub a lot better for me. And I came out with a much higher opinion of the movie.
Okay.
So.
Well, I mean, I only saw the dub. And I have a very high opinion of it. And it's not for lack of trying. Like, I was trying to kind of, while I'm watching the movie, because I'm insufferable, I was trying to poke holes in it and try to find things that I don't like, kind of because, you know, I was knowing I was going to end up talking about it on here, but the problems that I would have with it are kind of not problems if I look at the movie as it is and not look at it as I wanted it to be. And also don't look at it as the movie that follows Heroes Rising, because it can't.
Right. Nothing. that was my problem.
Yeah. And what I've noticed is that this is unfortunately the reality of the show at this point, where I'm wanting the show to follow Heroes Rising, and I don't think it can. I think the timing, I don't know if there's going to be better timing for anything like that to ever happen again. And like, once you learned that Heroes Rising, like that specific scene was going to be the original intended ending, it's like, oh man, yeah, that sure would have been great.
That would have been an incredible ending.
Yeah. Well, and like it being permanent. And like, then you kind of figuring out, oh, that makes sense. Like, nothing is going to be able to follow Heroes Rising, which, I mean, we have a whole podcast on that. You can listen to it. I think we talked for like 2 hours about that movie alone. But
yes,
for this one, I was like, now that I'm, you know, better learning about the structure and things like this, Deku is not the protagonist of this movie. Mm-mm. Deku is the mentor Most likely. I'd say his best role is the mentor for Rhodey in this movie.
Yes.
Because Rhodey is the one who changes. Rhodey is the one who beats the bad guy at the end. And I was like, I didn't think that was going to happen. I thought it was going to do this thing that would have made it to where the movie wasn't actually any good. Which the way you do that is you rob the protagonist of defeating the antagonist.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought it was about to do it, and then it didn't. It actually gave Rhodey the win. Rhodey was the one who stops the bombs. I mean, there was an awesome scene where Deku, you know, does the heroic belt thing, which
the most subsequent punches.
Well, no, but he first of all, the animation for that was incredible.
Yes,
but I think that's the first time he's done United States of Smash.
I actually don't think that.
You don't think so?
I think that he's done it before.
Okay. Well, if he has, I don't recall. But he had both arms completely blown out, despite his current control over that. If he did do United States of Smash before, it was because he had help from Airy. Like, maybe he did it on Overhaul.
That might be it.
Okay. I can hear you looking it up. If that's the case, this one is still a milestone in that he didn't have Airy healing him this whole time. He was actually going without the consistent healing, which means not only does he have better control over it, but he's also tougher than he was before, which is
right.
That's cool as him being the protagonist of the series overall. So that was a nice little moment that he got to have, because up to that point, he was more or less just being Gandalf. Like he was just being like, he really was this whole movie. I mean, they kind of established a sort of rapport, like as equals, like there was kind of a bromance going. But when you look at the structure, it's like Deku really is the wise person that is changing Rhodey through example.
He even does the "you shall not pass." Dang it!
Yeah, like, and I didn't even remember that until you just mentioned it. He totally does that. He even says that. He says, "You won't pass." Yeah,
you won't get past me.
Yeah. So he was the Gandalf of the story. He was not the protagonist. He wasn't the Frodo. Rhodey was. It was Rhodey.
I love. Especially after seeing it the second time. And that's the last time I'm going to say it, because all of the opinions that I share now are after the second viewing.
Yes. Well, they kind of are from the beginning.
Chronologically.
Sure, yeah. No flashbacks.
but I love the fact that it did shift. Like you were saying, the struggle that Rhodey was having was the ultimate struggle. And Deku, it was like holding back the force that would stop Rhodey.
Yeah. So the Balrog that would have stopped Frodo does defeat. Of course, you're looking at the first movie and also looking at like all three movies. But everyone in Lord of the Rings is holding off the forces of like Sauron's forces, as Frodo is the one who has to save them. Like, he has to be the one that does it in the end. And Rhodey, I mean, almost to a T, has, you know, the crack of doom moment. Like, he's barely alive at the end, and he gets the thing in the place that it has to go in order to stop everything. And I liked his quirk, and it wasn't expected. I was like, that was cool and that was clever.
And I will say, watching it a second time, knowing that, it makes a bunch of moments a lot sweeter.
Okay, cool.
It's not like it recontextualizes anything, because like, you kind of get the feeling, because the two characters are a pair, that they kind of like have the same feelings towards things.
Sure. Morph does that literally for
exactly,
for John Silver, which I think that's incredible. Like, watching this movie, I was like, Pino's kind of like Morph from Treasure Planet. And then he reveals his quirk, and I was like, oh my god. It was like, that's exactly what was happening, because Morph every time was showing exactly how Silver was feeling.
Right. And then when you find out that it's like an actual like expression of his emotions, not just like another character that's kind of like emulating that, it just makes some of the moments like, oh, that makes it a lot sweeter. So yeah. like when he's leaving the house and then Pino goes and kisses the two kids on the cheeks, and it's like, oh,
right. Well, while Rhodey's trying to be, you know, the cool rapscallion,
the cool big brother, right? Yes. Yeah.
Also, man, every single scene involving parkour, I think that studio really wanted to do that.
The chair rolling.
The chair roll was like the best moment of the entire movie, almost because of the way it was shot. Like it was like,
and it was,
and I love like what he said after the fact when he's like, still got it. Yeah. And like, he's effectively running from Deku, who has super speed and can like super jump. But
what's funny, I don't remember in the sub, I don't remember him saying still got it or knock knock when he was running by the window. I don't remember him saying either of those things.
Yeah. So I think in that moment I started to get the feeling like specifically on that scene. It was like the extremely cool camera work and choreography. I was like, Rhodey has got to be the protagonist. Because that is the scene you give your protagonist.
Yeah. And it focuses on him a lot more. I would almost say that he gets more screen time than Bakugo at the very most, or at the very least.
Well, no, he does get more screen time than Deku does.
Mm-hmm. Oh, he does. Yeah. Okay.
And the placement of the scenes, like, the, you know, you have your opening scene with the characters from the show. But the scene where it's him at, you know, in that trailer, and then it's him talking to the restaurant owner. It's like, yeah, these are the opening scenes for the main character.
Yeah.
And they did it correctly. Like, no, yeah. Having the context that he's the character that you're going to see grow and change. When you remember back to the beginning of the movie, it feels like you've come a long way. Whereas if you look at it in the context of Deku, it's like, okay, well,
he hasn't changed at all.
Right. So he was just right about things. That being said,
right,
he also gets at least a power level growth where, and I liked when Fleck Tarn was like, is he getting stronger? Like during the fight, which I do kind of begrudge Dragon Ball for saying the quiet parts out loud. And now people thinking that, oh, that's just a thing from Dragon Ball, where it's like there's this in universe lore thing about Saiyans, which is the closer they get to death after they heal, they're that much stronger. And it's like, okay, but that's everyone. It's like,
what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. Right? Like that's the saying.
That's literally how that works. But like in Dragon Ball, they just give that to a specific species. It's like, oh no, that's their thing. So when Deku does that, it's like, oh, it's like Dragon Ball. It's like, but it's like real life. Also, you could say that it was kind of a Deus Ex Machina, the way he beats Fleck Tarn, where Fleck Tarn, like his quirk is that he reflects everything. So you can't touch him. You can't damage him. And it's like, oh, how are you going to write yourself out of that corner? That dude is completely overpowered. And then the way they write themselves out, I thought was earned, at least.
Yes. I mean, I like the idea of no, keep doubling down.
Right. I mean, that's probably the most belt thing about that whole movie. Right. Is Deku's solution to beating Fleck Tarn is to just continue to hit him harder and harder. And like, Fleck Tarn doesn't have any reactions to it at first. He's just kind of like watching it happen, which, first of all, if you're going to use, you know, CGI to supplement your 2D animation, that was a cool way to do it. Like, the whole thing that like burst out behind him and then pushed back forward to like do the reflect.
It looked very unnatural.
Yeah. And I liked how it was clipping. I was like, that's kind of a cool visual signal that we've gotten purely from accident. And it's like actually ingrained into what we understand now. Like visually, it's like that doesn't belong. But yeah, I liked how the solution was Flex Tarn never pushed himself. And now he's learning he has
you
limits.
Gave up.
Yeah, it was like that line, almost the delivery of that line made it okay that it was a Deus Ex Machina. It's like, well, he kind of did. That's his whole his whole character is basically giving up.
Yeah.
And, you know, creating a genocidal religion out of it. But, you know.
Yeah, it was a little worse than what Amon was doing in Legend of Korra.
Yeah, which I did have a problem with that. I was like, okay, if you're murdering all of these people and then the humans, you know, that don't have meta abilities and their family members are just getting murked, I don't think they're going to want to join you, right. But that's just me.
Well, I mean, but it's also an apocalypse religion.
Right.
So, like death is mercy. So, I mean, you're not, he's not really confused. He's not really concerned with getting new members. He has the members he needs.
True.
Like he had the members he needed to like have this whole global terrorist attack. And, I mean, everything that happens after that is just providence. Like even if he dies in the process, it's like, well, at least I helped cleanse the world. But, I did like how it was, I liked how humorized this thing that is introduced and then defeated in this movie. So is sort of inconsequential. I did like how they felt completely developed and they kind of had, an ironclad philosophy versus the Meta Liberation Front's philosophy, which kind of leaves enough to the imagination to where it would continue to grow. It wouldn't have to have its final act or anything, which is actually very reflective of real, like, you know, philosophy and cults and religions and stuff like that. It's like whoever wrote this, which, if I'm not mistaken, at least if he didn't write it, he wrote the story, is the original creator of My Hero. The first movie he didn't do the story for. He did do it for 2 and 3, as far as I know.
Okay.
But he seems to have a good understanding about how that works from a big picture perspective, is that when you have a slightly incomplete philosophy, it can grow indefinitely. Like, because there's mystery to it.
Yeah.
It doesn't.
And people will fill in that mystery with whatever they need to join.
Right. And that mystery leaves a sort of humility on the person who created it, where it's like, I don't have all the answers, but this is as far as I know. And the humorized one is, of course, I mean, it's a time bomb. Because it has the final solution laid out right there for you. Like it has its end goal in the actual philosophy. So
right.
I thought that was smart. That was well done. Because it would burn bright and then burn out. You know, kind of like what's-his-face? Jim Jones or whatever.
Is that the Kool-Aid?
Yeah. Another apocalypse cult where it's like, that's the way that ends. And then it's over. Versus something like, I don't know, Gwyneth Paltrow, like
Goop.
Yeah, it's like, well, that's just buy more product, which isn't an end goal. It's like, no, continue to buy product. Keep buying product until you have more product and then you buy some more. So
that's right. We said Jim Jones and Gwyneth Paltrow in the same sentence.
Well, I mean, it's an endorsement. Gwyneth Paltrow is much better than Jim Jones. It's killing way fewer people. I'm not saying it's not killing anyone. That stuff's probably not good for you, but
I don't know. Some of them just seem like stickers.
That's true. Anyway, I liked the movie. I liked it a lot. When I think of the movie, the thing that I think about is how much I liked Rhodey's story. And I liked his character arc, which is, that's exactly what I needed to like. And I, you know, I can think of quite a few scenes that I enjoyed. Yeah. Bakugo's fight was brutal. It almost seemed like that was directed by someone else. Like that was, they had, you know, a few set pieces and sometimes, you know, it's like, I don't have time to do that. You handle that. Bakugo's fight was like absolutely like gut wrenchingly violent.
Yeah.
And I like,
and he was kind of scratched up.
Yeah. He was, I also liked that his one liner after they took the trigger where he was like, his reaction was more or less, okay,
I'm right there with you.
Yeah, if you guys want to get crazy, I'm right there with you.
That line was also better in the dub. Like the sub, it was something similar. I can't remember what it was, but the dub, it was just like almost everything that Bakugo said was just perfect in the dub.
I am going to say the sub in the sub, Bakugo seems to be more like a one note side character. Because he basically speaks in catchphrases, like die. Like he says that a lot more in the sub.
Yes.
Whereas in the dub, I think they try to do a little bit more with him. And I don't know if that's a good thing, because what it's setting people up for is something other than what I think is going to happen. Like
that's a good point.
If it had turned out that Heroes Rising was the way that ended, then Funimation made the definitive telling of that story. But I'm pretty sure Bakugo is going to remain where he is. He's going to remain as like, you know, like an equal, a parallel, but he is not the protagonist. This isn't going to end up being about him. He's going to play a smaller role than people think he is. In fact, he'll play the role a role the same size as Todoroki. You know, they'll be the Thor and the Captain America to Deku's Iron Man.
Yeah.
But speaking of that, are we probably done talking about the movie? Because I have one little thing I want to leave on in order to make you excited for the next season, but also make you kind of frustrated that we didn't pick up on it, and then also make you very uncomfortable.
I like discomfort. Tell me. Yeah, I don't have anything else on the movie. It was great. Go watch it.
Yeah.
After we spoiled everything.
I want you, or maybe this is going to take too long or is kind of inconvenient. So I suppose I can simply just tell you, but that doctor
In My Hero Season 5?
Yeah.
Yeah, Dr. Eggman looking guy?
Uh-huh.
Uh-huh.
He looked familiar to you? Other than looking like Dr. Eggman?
Oh my gosh, was that the doctor that was Midoriya that told him that he was quirkless?
Uh-huh. The very same.
What?
And we did not pick up on that. We should feel ridiculous.
I feel a little ridiculous.
But also, what could that mean? Because it could mean a lot. But the thing, now that, this is something I learned. It's a good life lesson. The thing you least want it to be is more than likely what it is. Just in anything. And when I say least want it to be, I don't mean that would be dumb. I mean, that would be quite perilous. I think this is going to be a little bit like Harry Potter ended. Deku might find out he's something he didn't think he was. That doctor was working quite closely with All for One.
Yeah.
And I mean, we had 9, and he's in the manga. He's canon. Mm-hmm. 9 was sort of a failed prototype, a failed attempt at getting someone to be the successor to All for One, you know, someone who could hold every quirk, essentially. Tomer Shigaraki is kind of a successor he's been trying to make. So he's trying to make all these successors, and he's been at it for a minute. And that doctor was involved in Shigaraki's at the very least.
And Deku's the first holder of One for All that has displayed the previous quirks from other than his successor.
Exactly. Or it has done more than just manifest itself in a unique way within him. He's getting the previous powers too. He also may have been lied to
about not having a quirk.
Yeah. He might have a quirk. This is what I'm saying. This revelation could lead to so many other things. He may have been lied to. And of course, this is speculation for a manga that's way ahead of this. And maybe we're just blowing smoke. But, you know, maybe someone already knows. But he may have a quirk that he was lied about. The quirk may have been taken, meaning he might be able to get it back. The original, or All for One's brother, is speaking to him directly, or at least did speak to him directly, and, you know, kind of left this as something that was waiting for the right person to come by. I think Deku has a stronger connection to All for One and this guy beyond what we've been shown. I mean, to be honest, it is a little strange that we know so little about Deku's father. And you'd also think,
I remember that popping up in a bunch of fan theories right when the show was like entering its second season. I remember people talking about that.
But the assumption is that Darth Vader is Luke's father. After Darth Vader was Luke's father one time, you start to think he's his father every time.
Right.
So it's possible. I mean, it could be as dry. Well, I mean, not that it would be stupid, but it could be very entertaining if All for One is secretly Deku's father. But it is sort of showing itself as to be one of those shows where kind of everyone's related. Like the whole thing with All Might's master is the grandmother of Tomura Shigaraki. So there is, you know, All for One definitely is participating in quite a bit of eugenics. But All for One has also been making people. Like, he's been creating beings, him and that doctor, like making Nomu and like doing all this stuff. I think that's the thing that I missed that would have made me far more satisfied and interested in where we're going now. That it just went over my head. Like, seeing that doctor and recognizing it as that guy would have gone a long way in making the end of season 5 way more interesting and making me way more excited for season 6. Because that could mean any number of things. The thing with Harry Potter is that Deku might be the equivalent of a Horcrux.
Yeah.
He could be a plant. And remember the mole? Remember the subplot about the mole that went nowhere and we just couldn't figure out who it was?
I vaguely remember that, yeah.
Yeah, there was a mole in the school. And they were thinking it was one of the teachers. And then maybe they're thinking it could be a student, but the investigation never turned anything up. Could it be that there might be an unwilling mole who's doesn't know that he's doing this? Could it also be that Deku's having some pretty vivid dreams where things get broken before he wakes up?
Oh, shoot. He did have that dream, didn't he?
Yeah.
Or that thing. Not dream, it happened.
There might be a bit of an MK Ultra subplot coming up.
All right, I am bought back in cautiously. I mean, I was not nearly off board as much as you were.
I was just really annoyed. Okay, I'm still annoyed with the way the story played out. It was very slapdash and amateurish out of nowhere. And it reeks of this has gone on for too long and we're buying time.
Yes. But I was still going to be watching season 6 when it airs.
Yeah, me too. I'm still interested in Deku. I've never been less interested in Tomura Shigaraki.
Yeah.
Like, the more I get from him, it's like, oh, can we just... At this point, you can just kill him off. But he's clearly not going to get any more interesting. He's still going to be the weakest part of the show.
Yeah.
Deku is already such a fully developed character that he's able to be the Gandalf in one of the movies. Right. Like, he's already developed enough as like a heroic main character that it's like, eh, he can do this to other people now. I don't even necessarily need to see where this goes, but I will, of course. I am very interested. But yeah, Tabitha pointed that out to me. She was like, yeah, so autoplay was on and it went to the first episode after the last episode. And that's the same doctor. And I was like, what?
I can't believe we didn't catch on to that.
I think we might be stupid.
Probably. We have smooth brain.
Yes. We should probably wrap it up there.
Yeah.
We've covered lots. We've covered plenty.
Yeah, and I feel like I can say go beyond plus ultra today.
Oh, yes, yeah, there we go. Feel good about that one. Mm. We should try to get one from Outlaw Star, but there are more zingers than battle cries.
Yeah.
I think we might get one later, but, you know.
Okay. Maybe we'll keep my ears peeled.
I hate it. I hate it so much. It hurts. Is next week Gurren Lagann?
Are we not going back to Saint Seiya?
I thought we did we not? Or wait, I'm totally confused. Okay, y'all probably know which order.
We'll figure it out.
I'll check in on that. Be like, oh wait, what was the last one? Yeah, we'll go to either Saint Seiya or Gurren Lagann, depending which one we're supposed to actually be doing.
Right.
See you on next week.
You'll see the title.
Killing people is bad. Dude, I wonder when season 3 of that is coming out.
Ooh.
I'll check off air. Bye.